Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Candace Bushnell tells New York stories. In Sex and the City, her Carrie Bradshaw dreamed big. In Lipstick Jungle, three high-powered best friends forever, New York women strive to have it all. With Wall Street's tumble, we're wondering if it's humble pie time in New York City now. And Bushnell is back with a new take, 1 Fifth Avenue. This hour on Point, Candace Bushnell on her New York, imagined and very real. You can join the conversation. Were you a Sex and the City fan? Are you cheering on the bold women of Lipstick Jungle? Are you wondering how it all works in the wreckage of Wall Street? Candace Bushnell joins me from New York. She's best-selling author of four books, most famously Sex and the City, which was the basis for the HBO series and the movie. Her novel Lipstick Jungle is now a drama starring Brooke Shields on NBC. Her new novel is 1 Fifth Avenue. The New York Post says you've got to love it. This Sunday, 1 Fifth Avenue debuts at number 5 on the New York Times bestseller list. Candace Bushnell, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom. Great to be here.
Looks like you're doing it again, number 5, just to start. That's not too bad. There's still an appetite out there on the other side of Wall Street's crash for New York stories.
Absolutely. Well, I always think of my work as being satire, and you know, as a source for stories, New York is never ending, and one of the things that I wanted to explore in 1/5 was in a sense how New York doesn't change. The characters change, but the play remains the same, which is a line that the screenwriter Philip Oakland says to his aunt at the beginning of the book. And you know, the stories of you know, the, in a sense, the rise and fall and rise and fall of the goings on in New York City is it's a continual cycle. And you know, since people have been writing novels about Manhattan, that has always been one of the big themes. New York is a place where people come to make it, and there's always a fresh crop that comes in, leaves their small town, feels like they're a little bit different than the people who they grew up with, and comes to New York to make it.
But does it change? I mean, Sex and the City and, you know, the monoblanics and all the money on everything all over, and Big sliding up in his limousine as kind of a icon at the heart of this thing. It seemed so much about the decade and maybe more in which the financial industry was putting New York into really deep gravy, money all over the place. Nobody even thinks twice about it in those stories and what we saw on HBO. You know, it's all glossy. And now on the downside, can it really be the same? The same kind of frivolity, fun, and New York glitter glam?
Well, first of all, having moved to New York in the late 70s, just about at the time when the New York Post had that famous headline, I think it was President Ford, "Ford to New York, drop dead."
And things were rough. Crime in the streets and grubby all over.
The city was broke. There was a very different atmosphere when I first moved to New York. First of all, it was much more dangerous than it is now. And you certainly could not leave your car on the street for 5 minutes without your car being broken into. At the same time, it was a city of probably more frivolity and possibly even more creativity, because it was a time when I think, you know, all of that 80s art came out of this time in the 70s when it was one of the times when the city wasn't being run by bankers. It was being sustained by all of the creative people who had come to New York to express their creativity and, you know, were willing and accepted the idea that you're going to be a starving artist, but you are going to find others of, you know, a like ilk. And in those days, I remember everywhere you went in New York, there was music on the streets. People had boom boxes on the subways, and there were wild, wild clubs like Studio 54.
Yep.
And New York just absolutely celebrated the creativity of the city in our fashion designers and our novelists and our painters. I mean, these were our celebrities.
And that's about the time you came. I know that I want to talk about it, but that was sort of came up out of Andy Warhol's New York and sort of a midnight cowboy era, funky New York.
Absolutely. And, you know, I remember in 1980, I had a boyfriend who had an older brother who was an investment banker.
Mm-hmm.
And we laughed our heads off because we had no idea what he did. You know, nobody had no clue of you know, how they made money. And all we knew was that his brother somehow had managed to, you know, was living in a 3-bedroom apartment, and his brother was rich, and we had no idea what he did. We used to laugh about it. And that was the first investment banker I met, and that was in 1980. And from then on, that segment really, really grew.
Do you have the feeling? Do you have the feeling now that's over? That the 3 apple martini lunches and the $1,000 shoes are receding into the past of New York as the dominant theme, or are just coming back in another guise? Is the party over?
No, it isn't. I mean, one of my fifth book.
Mm-hmm.
Sex and the City's not technically a novel because it's journalism and fiction.
Right, of course.
So,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's this little technicality that one fifth is my fourth novel. It's mm-hmm. actually my fifth book. And through the 90s, I wrote and into the early and then in you know, 2000, in the, you know, 2001, I wrote Four Blondes, which was about the excesses of New York. And then when I wrote Trading Up, I started writing it in 2001, right after 9/11. And the book takes place in the year 2000 very, very specifically. And it is a satire of the excesses of New York City in a time where everybody felt that they were doing the same thing over and over and over again. And there's a weariness to the parties and the excess, which I think very much captures the city before 9/11, where, you know, there was plenty of money and people just thought that life would go on and on and on unchanged. And then, of course, there was 9/11. And that obviously had a huge effect on the city. But as I say in the book, one fifth, after 9/11, the financial segment certainly continued and found all kinds of new ways to make money. I think that they've gotten themselves into a huge amount of trouble, but
themselves,
you know,
and maybe
things will come back,
but maybe everybody else as well. And a lot of people talking about something being over. We sort of look to you for a sense of what that might be, even though things remain the same. I'm looking here at New York Post, page 6 magazine, photo spread of you along with a kind of a bio to go along with the publication of One Fifth Avenue. Gee, you look like one of your characters on TV. I mean, you're up against the New York skyline here, looking very slim and glam. with a $5,000 Bill Blass dress and $50,000 worth of jewels, and you're very glam indeed. Are you part of the scene that we saw described in Sex and the City? Is that your life?
Well, I started writing Sex and the City in 1994. Mm-hmm. And I was 34 years old. I was a single woman, in my mid-30s. And Sex and the City was really social anthropology. And at that time, because of this big influx of young women who went into the workforce in the late 70s and early 80s to have it all, coming off of 70s feminism. Like myself, many of these women found that while they could have careers, they just didn't seem the rules between men and women had changed, and they couldn't find men to make permanent commitments. And then one of the things that happened is the women got a little bit older. They were a little bit more successful in their careers, being in their early 30s. And, for me, one of the things that I've observed is a lot of people's behavior is dictated by money, status, and power.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Sex and the City creator Candace Bushnell about her new novel, One Fifth Avenue, and the new landscape, social, sexual, and otherwise, of a post-financial meltdown, New York. One Fifth Avenue, you can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Property, a big, beautiful piece of real estate, and all the apartments, the condos in it, at the heart of One Fifth Avenue. The villain this time, a creepy hedge fund manager. Let's listen back to a little bit of property talk from Sex and the City. Here's a scene where Carrie Bradshaw, played by Sarah Jessica Parker, tells her friend she's moving in with Big. Miranda, Cynthia Nixon, points out the imbalance of that arrangement because only Big will own the apartment, not Carrie and Big. Carrie won't let anybody rain on her parade.
For now, can't you stop worrying for me and just go ahead and feel what I want you to feel? Jealous. Oh, jealous of me living in this gorgeous penthouse in Manhattan.
All right, I'm jealous.
Oh, thanks.
You live in real estate heaven, and I live in Brooklyn.
New York Magazine said Brooklyn is the new Manhattan.
Oh,
whoever wrote that lives in Brooklyn.
Jealous, just be jealous, says Carrie Bradshaw there in Sex and the City. Candace Bushnell joins us from New York. Let's begin to turn to our callers. Matt in Greenwich, Connecticut. You're on the air with Candace Bushnell, Matt.
Yes, hello, Tom. Hello, Candace. Thanks for the call. Listen, I'm fascinated by this conversation as a veteran, or I guess you could say alumni, of the 90s in New York and all of its excesses. And I guess what I'd love to talk to Candace about and hear her comments on is it reminds me of a certain kind of love-hate relationship with this satire, the things we satire, and the money and the status and the power that is New York, which really does kind of sink down into a sexual theme as well, which you've written and shown and portrayed so much. Well, I guess my question to you is this: whether the message is subtle or overt in satirizing a society or a culture that really glorifies, satirizing the glamour and all that. And at the same time, I wonder if we're guilty, or you're guilty, frankly, of glorifying a kind of superficiality or self-absorption, a kind of chic epicureanism, of those three martini lunches and that kind of catty, petty, shallow jealousy that is New York and is Greenwich, frankly. And I think at the bottom line, I wonder if it's kind of like Walt Whitman's description of immoral reform, when you portray a vice so vividly that you actually become part of the vice, in a sense, and there is this schizophrenia where you're making fun of something but very much a part of it, and that we become a part of it. In all of this, you wonder if the message becomes the message or the joke becomes the message, and I'll leave my comment there.
Oh, Matt, thanks very much. Candace, portraying the vice so vividly you become part of it. What do you say?
Jealous.
So you're Carrie Bradshaw now.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know what? I don't want to insult our caller, but I think that's a common perception that somehow the novelist is their character. And I've kind of heard this idea before that I've promoted materialism. As a novelist, if I could promote materialism, gosh, I wish I was that powerful. But I can promise you that there is no novelist who can change people. People are materialistic, have been for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And I think it's incredibly naive to think that, you know, this commercialism and rampant consumerism is caused by something that you see on TV or you read in a book.
Are you totally serious, though? You know the power of media. I mean, that show was all over the country.
What I do, Tom, is my books are satire and they are social commentary and social anthropology. And I write about what I see. The character of Lola Fabricant, for instance.
This is the young gold digger who comes to New York
young,
in 1/5th Avenue.
Let's call gold digger.
Mm-hmm.
She absolutely personifies a young woman who has grown up in a time where there are, she reads magazines and she watches media and she feels, as people have felt forever, that if she has certain consumer goods, she will be a member of a tribe and will be okay. And that is human nature, like it or not. I don't think in any way that I've affected human nature. In case you don't realize, our entire economy is predicated on the consumer index. That is our economy. I did not invent our economy. And when the economy, when the consumers are spending money, our economy is doing well. When consumers are not spending money, our economy is considered not to be doing well. That is what our economy is predicated on. And
Let me finish.
Yeah,
sure, yes,
everything in our lives
is
about selling things to people. And that ranges from McDonald's hamburgers to Manolo Blahnik shoes. And if you really want to think about it, a McDonald's hamburger is the perfect product because you have told people. You are selling people what everybody thinks they need. People feel they need food. And the McDonald's hamburger is the perfect product. And that kind of fast food has been enormously damaging to our culture. So, I mean, if you're going to compare fast food to shoes, I mean, really.
I don't think Matt is. I think he's thinking more about the Bill Blass dress and the Kimberly McDonald brown diamond briolette necklace.
So what?
Well, I mean, he's asking if we've celebrated
a sheep
epicurean.
Yes? It's a fashion shoot, okay? It is a fashion shoot.
I do not own
those clothes. Those clothes are borrowed for a fashion shoot.
Does it change? Is it over? Does it just go on? Does it really go on when we don't have those $100 million bonuses? How important were they to creating the environment that you described and maybe describe again in 1/5th Avenue? If they go away, Congress's hearings now all over these guys down their throats. If the big, big, big money goes away, does it change this whole pyramid of consumption from the top where 1/5th Avenue certainly sits?
Well, when I was walking around New York City today, I was thinking, there's somehow an underlying feeling of, I think, maybe normality and relief. One of the things that drove me to write 1/5th Avenue and and I think this is very, very clear in the book, and that is that, as we all know, the amount of money that these hedge fund people made in proportion to the middle classes was an enormous number. And even in the days of the robber barons and the Rockefellers, that proportion of money made by the very, very rich was maybe 100, 200 times what the middle class made. Mm-hmm. In the times that we live in, the amount of money that these CEOs and hedge fund managers make is 1,000, 2,000, maybe it's 10,000 times what the middle class person makes. And that is what really, really skews the culture. Now, in terms of those people buying $5,000 dresses, you know, the wives, yes, I suppose perhaps they do. But more importantly are the other things that they buy, which are real estate and art. I mean, when a Picasso painting is $50 million, I mean, that's unfathomable. And then what happens are things that should be accessible to everyone, like art, are not accessible. If you want to talk about the fashion industry, I'm very, very happy to talk to you about the fashion industry. That is one of the biggest industries in New York.
You know, I'd rather stick with money for a minute.
You've got,
and maybe a little reading here. You've got your hedge fund manager and his wife. This is Paul and Annalisa. Right at the outset of the book, you've got, 1 Fifth Avenue, very glamorous address, but many different kinds of apartments, condos within it, and from pretty down and dirty to the 7,000-square-foot, three-story penthouse at the top, $15 million. Paul and Annalisa have moved in, and you've got a little conversation where they're talking about their frustrations, even up in their glorious penthouse. I think it's page 170, Candace. Could you read a bit for us there?
I will. Perhaps everything had gone too far. Despite the progress Annalisa made on the apartment, Paul was unhappy. The lottery had been held for the parking spot in the Mews, and Paul hadn't won. Coupled with this disappointing news was a letter from Mindy Gooch officially informing them that their request for through-the-wall air conditioning units had been denied. "We'll make it work without them," Annalisa had said, trying to soothe Paul. "I can't," Paul said. "We have to," Annalisa said. Paul glared at her. "It's a conspiracy," he insisted. "It's because we have money and they don't." "Mrs. Houghton had money," Annalisa said, trying to reason with him. "And she lived here without any trouble for years." "She was one of them," Paul countered, "and we're not." "Paul," she said patiently, "what are you talking about?" "I'm making real money now," he said, "and I expect to be treated with a certain amount of respect." "I thought you were making real money 6 months ago," she said, attempting to lighten the situation. $40 million isn't real money," Paul said. $100 million is getting there.
Paula and Annalisa at the top of 1/5th Avenue in Candace Bushnell's new novel. And she goes on to wonder, perhaps too much money was like too much sex, Annalisa's thinking. It crossed the line and became pornographic.
Yes, and I wonder that myself.
Does it? Did it?
I think it did.
Yeah, a lot of others may think the same. Let's get a call from Lee in Boston. Hi, Lee, you're on the air with Candace Bushnell.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just want to say that, Candace, I really enjoy your writing, and I really enjoy Sex and the City, the series that, you know, was based off of your writing. And I lived in New York for a good 9 or 10 months. I'm pretty young. I'm 22, and I was in a band that got signed, so I moved there. And that's when I really got into the series and got into your writing. And I, you know, I sort of brush off anybody who accuses Sex and the City of being sort of this frivolous, stupid, you know, parody of, like, women and their sex lives. Like, I think that, you know, the sort of dialogue that has started really set the scene for my generation in terms of talking about this stuff. You know,
when you say this stuff, Lee, what do you mean?
You know, sex, relationships, the sort of politics, sexual politics between men and women, especially in this, like, in this day and age, you know, post-feminism, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, just remember, as Gloria Steinem recently said, that term post-feminism is like post-democracy. It's a little ridiculous. But I do want to say that I think if... Look, I don't think that Sex and the City was frivolous. I think for many women, and what most women have said to me, is that it's the celebration of the friendships between the women that is so important to them. And the reality is that, you know, 50 years ago, women had, we had very different lives. We tended to go from our families, from our homes that we grew up in, to making a new home right away with a man. That no longer happens. 50% of women are single. So that means that you're likely going to have a period when you leave your family home and you go out into the world. And the friendships and the support that women give to each other are crucial in terms of survival. And I think for many, many women, the sexual politics that Sex and the City dealt with were the same thoughts and fears and issues that they themselves were dealing with. You know, the shoes and the clothes were fun, but it was really the gloss. It was really the icing on the cake. And I appreciate your call.
Lee, thanks very much. Candace Bushnell, we've got a new female figure very prominent in the country right now in these last, well, I guess it's just a few weeks. Governor Palin, Sarah Palin of Alaska. Self-described pit bull with lipstick. Proud of it, happy with it. Bunch of kids and a big job, too. Wow. How does she intersect with the view of feminine power, work, and life that you've caught in New York? Is she part of the picture or blowing up your picture?
I think she's part of the picture. For me, this was what inspired Lipstick Jungle. The women who were in their 30s when I was writing Sex and the City, 10 years later, are in their 40s. Many of them have resolved a lot of their relationship issues. They're married. I know many women who started to have children in their early to mid-40s. And they've been working for 20 years, and they have high-powered careers. And some of these women are the breadwinners in their family. And I think, you know, while Lipstick Jungle focuses on women having glamorous careers, the reality is that model is not restricted to women in big cities or women with glamorous careers. I've met women who work at Walmart, who are the manager of a Walmart, and they are the ones who are supporting their families.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with Sex and the City creator Candace Bushnell about her new novel, One Fifth Avenue, and the new landscape, social, sexual, and otherwise of a post-financial meltdown New York. Let's hear just a little bit from Lipstick Jungle. Here's a bit in the latest TV venture on NBC, of course. Three high-powered women work through life's ups and downs together. Here's a scene where Victory, played by Lindsay Price, gets bad reviews on her fashion show. Best friends forever, Wendy and Nico, played by Brooke Shields and Kim Ravner, are there to help pick up the pieces. Nico serves up tough love that might be advice for Wall Street right now.
You can't hide. A true player responds to disaster as if nothing's happened. When they smell fear in this town, it's over.
Oh, and we all have those dark moments in the middle of the night.
I don't.
She said not helping the situation.
Well, I don't. And I find it offensive that women always feel that we have to apologize for our success.
A little bit of advice there from Lipstick Jungle. Let's get a caller from New Jersey, Chatham, New Jersey, and Connie. Connie, you're on the air with Candace Bushnell.
Hi, Candace. Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I am a sociologist, and I teach a class on family sociology. And, Candace, I can't tell you how much Sex and the City has changed my syllabus. We talk about themes from the show all the time, social class, gender roles, changing gender roles, working women, also the Lipstick Jungle themes of working families, women heading families and trying to balance it all.
And you hold it up as a model, an anti-model, just a kind of an observer's guide. How do you use it, Connie?
It's really, you're right, it's an observer's guide. I think it's a great way to use examples that the students can understand of kind of larger themes in the class. One example is, we were just talking about that lengthening of time between the time women leave their family homes and enter into a marriage. And what will they do during that time? And they go to school, they start careers, they cohabit, they might break up, they might then marry someone else. And so that lengthening of time between the time women leave home and start families is really what's changed so much about women's lives today.
Do your students respond to it? Do they see it as a window into their lives, even if they're not in the $1,000 shoes?
No. I really wanted to call to say something about the shoe point is that, you know, I'm a professor. I might have a pair of shoes worth $100, but I never think about that when I watch the show. That is, it's just window dressing, because I think the real themes of the show are that, you know, women really need each other, and women have a lot more opportunities now, and they're going to take advantage of them. And why shouldn't they have those shoes? But I really see that as window dressing. It's not at all the main part of the show.
Connie, thanks very much for calling. Candace.
You know, thank you, Connie. And Tom, I have to say, talking to you, honestly, I feel a little bit like you're kind of missing the point here of my work. I just have to tell you that. I mean, this sort of obsession with, you know, the shoes are $1,000. And, you know, it's really beside the point. And I want to clear something up with you right here.
Let's go.
I have been writing professionally since I was 19.
Mm-hmm.
I came to New York with no money. And like many, many novelists, I sent out my work, you know, spent my last $20 on stamps. One of the first pieces, things that I was paid for professionally was a children's book for Simon & Schuster, mm-hmm. and I was paid $1,000. Mm-hmm. And in my 20s and early 30s, as somebody who was always working on novels, working on fiction, I supported myself by writing for women's magazines, writing these sociological pieces that were precursors to Sex and the City. And I never really made probably a normal, even average amount of money until I was 34 or 35. Mm. And in that period before, I went without most of the things that people would take for granted. I did not have a car. I did not have an apartment. I did not have cutlery. I did not have a bed. So, the shoes and the clothes are the window dressings. And also, I write about what is in our culture. That, you know, the shoes and the clothes are part of our culture. And for God's sake, if you've ever read Madame Bovary, you know that Flaubert spent 5 years getting the details of what she wore absolutely right.
You know, the details are wonderful, and you may misunderstand me. I hear the dues paid, and why not? It's really, my point is more exactly to this, the culture and the dressing of it, because dressing matters, whether it's in Flaubert or in Bushnell. But the way your work has represented this kind of came out in this Gilded Age, came to such a prominence in this Gilded Age time, really leaves me wondering how it shifts, how it turns, if and when our economy is turning. I mean, we celebrated all this stuff as an entire culture. This was front and center in many corners of the media, not just your work. And I'm so curious about where that goes if. You know, we've got Wall Street falling off a cliff and markets around the world doing the same. Nobody knows where this is going to end. Time magazine's got the Depression, for heaven's sakes, on its cover this week. That's a long way from that setting, and I wonder what happens to the setting and the people in it if we're tumbling down that hill now.
Well, for me, it's more material.
Does it work for you? Does it draw your eye? Is it what you want to write about? Time magazine.
Tom, I write about contemporary life, and I'm sorry, but I feel like my work is a reflection of the times that we're in. And in One Fifth Avenue, it deals with the mortgage crisis, mm-hmm. and you know some of the ridiculousness of what hedge funders are doing. And I mean, I think. You know, the questions that you should be asking are, I mean, for instance, what's going to happen to the internet in this kind of crisis? What kinds of things are people going to be interested in on the internet? Are they going to be interested in these kind of ridiculous celebrity sites? Are people going to be as interested in celebrities at all? I mean, vast celebrity
yep.
culture. I mean, are people going to be interested in that? I mean, you know, for me, I've been writing for 30 years. And if in 2 years from now, I write a book and my characters don't have money, they don't have money. And you know, that will be one of the realities of their lives and probably a challenge. I think it's an interesting topic.
I wish you'd take us in maybe with a little more reading here. You've got characters in One Fifth Avenue who are not up at the top of that address. They're kind of in the warren of rooms at the bottom. Mindy and her husband, James, who's looking to make it big writing, they're not in the penthouse. Maybe you'd read a little bit that gives us their perspective on their glamorous address.
In the summer, the low-ceilinged rooms were hot. In the winter, cold. The biggest room in the Warren, the one the Gooches used as their living room, had a shallow fireplace. Mindy imagined it as a room once occupied by a major domo, the head of all servants. Perhaps he had lured young female maids into his room and had sex with them. Perhaps he had been gay. And now, 80 years later, here she and James lived in those same quarters. It felt historically wrong. After years and years of pursuing the American dream, of aspirations and university educations and hard, hard work, all you got for your efforts these days were servants' quarters in Manhattan, and being told you were lucky to have them. While upstairs, one of the grandest apartments in Manhattan was empty, waiting to be filled by some wealthy banker type, probably a young man who cared only about money and nothing about the good of the country or its people, who would live like a little king in an apartment that morally should have been hers and James.
How do Mindy and James deal with their Warren? We hear the resentment right there. How's it play out in their interaction with the big money upstairs?
Well, James thinks their apartment is fine, and Mindy is very ambitious, and her ambition has been thwarted somewhere along the way, and her ambition has been thwarted by her personality. There's a passage where Mindy has told that Mindy is the head of a department in a media company, and she's been told that she's gone as far as she will go and no further because she does not have the personality to mix with the people who are at the very top. And, you know, one of the things that interests me about life is that it doesn't always work out the way one hopes. And I think that when one is young, one sort of feels like the sky's the limit. Anything can happen. And when one gets to be middle-aged, one realizes this may be it. And, you know, it's part of the life cycle. And, you know, part of being successful, and I mean emotionally successful and happy in your middle age, is to found what you love to do and to be able to give up, you know, some of the outside, you know, markers of, you know, of success. I mean, it's I think as you get older, it's more and more important that your happiness comes from inside and from a feeling of accomplishment. That's one of the things that I've tried to explore.
Claudia Dean read 1/5 Avenue for the Washington Post and says this is a kind of generational war among women here. She describes you, I don't know how you take this on, as a chick lit matriarch. I guess you're 49 now out of those 30s, and says what you're painting here is a picture of a kind of contest between younger, in a way, harder up and comers in New York City, and maybe women, maybe of that age, coming to this. Just the kind of conclusion you're describing there. What do you think of that, the all-girl generational war framing that she sees in 1/5 Avenue?
It's not new. And, I mean, first of all, this is not about women versus women. You know, there are some young characters in the book. There's a young blogger named Thayer Kaur, and there's Lola Fabricant, and those characters are, in a sense, by the end of the book, we see that they're a young version of James and Mindy Gooch. And I think it's normal and it's natural that young people, they are full of ambition. They are, in a sense, it's human nature for them to want to tear down the establishment and establish themselves. And, you know, again, I'm going to use that word, human nature. I mean, I know that when I was in my 20s, you know, one thinks that people who are older and successful have somehow gotten there by selling their soul to the devil. What one doesn't understand when one is 25 is really just how hard most people who are successful have worked. There's really no other key. There's no other factor. It really is always about doing a little bit of the extra work, and it's about doing the best job with what you are working on at the moment, whether that is sharpening pencils or, you know, I don't know, you know, you name it. But it's natural that young people want to tear down the people who are ahead of them. And gosh, if they didn't, I don't know where we would be as human beings, you know?
Well, the generations move on that way. I wonder how you feel about the difference between how people perceive your work from its TV presentation and movie and what you've actually written. Lev Grossman read your work, the latest book for Time magazine. I mean, he's funny on one level. He says it sounds like you wrote it in a helicopter on the way to the Hamptons with a cigarette and a martini in one hand. But
which
he says
is wonderful, and
very,
I suppose
funny.
It adds to my mythology.
Yeah,
but
honestly,
I wrote it probably wearing flip-flops, and I work about 12 hours a day.
But he says you're bleaker on the page tougher on the page than on the screen. That there are bleak truths here that Carrie Bradshaw could never grasp. He writes, reading, he says, women control men with sex. Men control women with money. Marriage is a Punch and Judy slugfest that ends with divorce or one party's total subjugation. Power and pleasure are the only things that are real, and they endlessly swap places as means and end. Do you think he's reading you right?
I think it's a little simplistic. But I thought it was a very good review and very entertaining.
Where do you go next? You're writing for younger people, chick lit, for teenage women. What do you want to bring them?
Well, I've signed a contract with HarperCollins to do two young adult books about Carrie Bradshaw's early years. You know, for me, I see Carrie Bradshaw as an independent thinker, you know, an observer, somebody who doesn't follow the crowd, you know, an observer of, probably social rituals first in high school. And then I imagine I'll bring her to Manhattan due to certain circumstances. And I think it will be a coming of age novel.
Have you got a title yet? Sex and the Something, or a whole different direction?
I think the working title is The Carrie Diaries. So
that sounds like a seller. Candace Bushnell's latest novel, her new book, is 1/5th Avenue. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Candace Bushnell, thanks so much for joining us today from New York. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.